Hello, this is Donald, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 5th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Rapid technology shift adds wrinkle for already strained educators. AI could worsen school inequalities. By Katie Davis and Asui Dangal, University of Washington, The Conversation. Today's teachers find themselves thrust into a difficult position with generative AI. New tools are coming online at a blistering pace and being adopted just as quickly, whether they're personalized tutors and study buddies for students or lesson plan generators and assignment graders for teachers. Schools are traditionally slow to adapt to change, which makes such rapid-fire developments especially destabilizing. The uncertainties accompanying the artificial intelligence onslaught come amid existing challenges the teaching profession has faced for years. Teachers have been working with increasingly scarce resources and even scarcer time while facing mounting expectations not only for their students' academic performances but also their social emotional development. Many teachers are burned out and they're leaving the profession in record numbers. All of this matters because teacher quality is a single most important factor in school influencing student achievement, and the impact of teachers is greatest for students who are most disadvantaged. How teachers end up using or not using AI to support their teaching and their students' learning may be the most critical determinant of whether AI's use in schools narrows or widens existing equity gaps. We have been conducting research on how public school teachers feel about generative AI technologies. The initial results, which are currently under review, reveal deep and ambivalence about AI's growing role in K-12 education. Our work also shows how inadequate training and unclear communications could worsen existing inequalities among schools. A thought partner for busy teachers. As part of a larger project examining AI interrogation in education, we interviewed 22 teachers in a large public school district in the United States that has been an early and enthusiastic adapter of AI. The district serves a multilingual and socio-economical diverse student population, with over 160 languages spoken and approximately 3/4 of the students eligible for free or reduced price lunch. The teachers who participated in our study span elementary, middle school, and high school grade levels and represented a variety of subject areas, including science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, social studies, special education, and culturally and linguistically diverse education. We asked these teachers to describe how they first encountered generative AI tools. In their classrooms, mirroring a recent survey finding that AI helps teachers save up to 6 hours per week of work, the teachers in our study pointed to AI's ability to create more space in the day for themselves and their students. Turning to AI for help writing lesson plans and assessments not only saves time, but it also gives teachers a tool for brainstorming ideas, helping them feel less isolated in their work. One high school teacher with over 11 years experience reflected, "The most significant benefit that AI has brought to my life as a teacher is having work-life balance. It has decreased my stress level 80-fold because I am able to have a thought partner. Teachers are really isolated. Even though we work with people constantly, when I'm exhausted, it gives me support and help with ideas. Why lack of training matters. However, not all teachers felt well equipped to benefit from AI. Much of what they told us boiled down to a lack of resources and other professional support. An elementary school classroom teacher explained, "It's just a lack of time. We don't really get much planning time, and would be a new tool to learn. So we would have to take the time personally to learn how to use it and where to find everything." Many teachers underscored their need for and current lack of professional development offerings to help them understand and integrate AI into their teaching. Research on previous waves of technology innovations shows that under-resourced schools serving disadvantaged students are typically the least well-equipped to provide teachers with professional support they need to make the most of new technologies. Because well-resourced schools are far more likely to offer such support, the introduction of new technologies in schools tends to reinforce existing inequities in the education system. When it comes to AI, well-resourced schools are best positioned to give teachers time, support, and encouragement to tinker with AI and discover how and whether it can support their teaching and learning goals. You need a relationship to learn. Our research also uncovered the importance of preserving the relational nature of teaching and learning, even or perhaps especially in an age of AI. As one middle school social studies teacher observed, a machine can give you information, but most students we know are not able to get information from something that just printed out for them and put into their heads. You need a relationship. That's why we believe the practices established during this current period of rapid AI development and adoption will profoundly influence whether education inequities are dismantled or deepened. Grounded in the classroom. Going forward, we see the need for research to examine how generative AI is changing teachers' practice and relationship in their work. Their input can inform practices that empower teachers or professionals and advance student learning. This approach requires adequate institutional support at the school and district levels. It also means listening to the real experience of teachers and students instead of responding to the promised benefits touted by education technology companies. United Way Giving Tuesday event raises over $900,000. By Korea Weaver, Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, USA Today Network. United Way of Greater Rochester and their Finger Lakes had their annual fundraising event December 2nd to give the community a chance to support causes they care about most. United Way's ROC, the day is a 24-hour online giving extravaganza. The fundraiser takes place each year on Giving Tuesday, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. This year, over 500 nonprofits representing a 9-county Greater Rochester and the Finger Lakes region participated. Donors were able to go online and choose any number of nonprofits and causes to support. United Way's annual event draws strong community response. United Way's goal was to raise $1 million for nonprofits. After receiving 5,982 donations, sponsorships, and challenge grants, this year they were able to raise $938,138 for the region. Aaron Bombard, Director of Marketing and Communications at United Way, said they could not be more proud of how close they got to achieving their goal. We understand that a lot of families are struggling right now, and our nonprofit community is facing a perfect storm of challenges with increased demands and funding uncertainties. Bombard said in a statement, "The fact that our community still showed up and gave the way they could to support the cause that they were cared about is inspiring. You know, United Way has been holding this event for 15 years, and collectively they have raised over $13 million for the community through the event." A nonprofit that uses this fundraising event is St. Joseph's Neighborhood Center. For them, ROC, the day is an important piece of the development program. Tiffany Payne Cicerone, Director, Development and Communications at St. Joseph Neighborhood Center, said they get well over 100 donations each year. This year they received over 125. Cicerone described how these donations go towards providing medical and mental health care for the uninsured and underinsured in the area. "Our nonprofit is really bracing for impact in terms of changes coming in the medical care on the federal level, so we are anticipating an increase in patients, and these dollars could really be critical for us to be able to continue providing services," Cicerone said. New York health officials criticize CDC guidance on vaccines autism, by David Robinson, New York State Team, USA Today Network. New York health officials denounced new wording on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website that suggested vaccines could be linked to autism. The U.S. Public Health Agency website was changed November 19th to say that the claim vaccines do not cause autism is not an evidence-based claim because studies have not ruled out the possibility that infant vaccines cause autism. It added that the health authorities have ignored studies supporting the link between the two. On November 24th, state health officials in New York, as well as the recently formed Northeast Public Health Collaborative, issued a statement that the CDC's stance was inconsistent with decades of research and more than 40 carefully designed and scientifically sound studies involving 5.6 million people that show no link or association between vaccines and autism. The situation marked the latest clash between Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s federal health agencies and the Northeast Public Health Collaborative, a voluntary group of regional public health agencies and leaders from several states and municipalities, including New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Maine, Rhode Island, and New York City. Previously, the Northeast Health Group has issued guidance in September seeking to promote wide uptick of the new COVID-19 vaccine recommendations, bucking federal guidance that aimed at limiting access to the shots. After the CDC's website changed, the Northeast Group noted claims suggesting a cause and effect relationship between vaccines and autism are not supported by credible scientific evidence, nor are they grounded in rigorous peer-reviewed research and consensus. The claims of a link between vaccines and autism spread inaccurate information, will result in unnecessary confusion, and may lead to unnecessary fear and harm, the group added, before asserting vaccines are safe and help prevent illness, hospitalization, and millions of deaths worldwide every year. What to know about New York's vaccination rate and changes. A crucial factor sustaining New York's childhood vaccination rate was state lawmakers' repeal of religious or non-medical school vaccine exemption in 2019. By contrast, other states have seen spikes in school vaccination exemptions granted for religious or non-medical reasons as vaccine misinformation increased during and after the COVID-19 pandemic, fueling distrust in science and medicine. Still, New York has seen cracks in its vaccination coverage in other areas, including ongoing struggles to boost the rate of children getting the first measles, mumps, and rubella dose by age 2, as recommended by state health officials. At the same time, the state has seen plummeting vaccination rates for children and adults for several non-school required vaccines such as flu and COVID-19. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump planning reset of fuel economy standards. Rules to affect cars from models 2022 through 2031. By Swampa Venugopal Ramaswamy, USA Today. President Trump announced at the White House on December 3rd that he is rolling back fuel efficiency standards for cars and trucks set by the Biden administration, a move that makes it easier for automakers to sell gas-powered vehicles. Signed into law in 1975, the corporate average fuel economy standards regulate how far vehicles must travel on a gallon of fuel. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is expected to propose reducing the fuel economy requirements for model years 2022 to 2031, a move that will save Americans $109 billion, a White House official told USA Today. The Biden administration in 2022 announced new standards which required an industry-wide fleet average of approximately 49 miles per gallon for passenger cars and light trucks in model year 2026. The new standards, the Department of Transportation said in 2022, would increase fuel efficiency 8% annually from model years 2024 to 2025, and 10% annually for the model year 2026. That would also have increased the estimated fleet-wide average by nearly 10 miles per gallon for model year 2026 compared with model year 2021. In June 2024, the Biden administration announced that fuel economy will increase 2% per year for the models years 2027 through 2031 for passenger cars, while light trucks will increase 2% per year for the model years 2029 through 2031. The increases would have brought fuel economy up to approximately 50.4 miles per gallon by the model year 2031. That would have saved passenger car and light truck owners more than $600 in fuel over the lifetime of their vehicles, the Biden administration said. The fuel economy requirements for the 2022 to 2031 model year vehicles are expected to be significantly reduced, though it was unclear how much it would be reduced by. Earlier this year, Trump signed legislation that ended fuel economy penalties for automakers. The NHTSA said they faced no fines dating back to the 2022 model year. Trump has taken a series of steps to make it easier for automakers to sell gasoline-powered vehicles and desensitize EV production, including rescinding EV tax credits and barring California from banning the sale of traditional gas-powered vehicles after 2035. In June, Trump signed three Congressional Review Act resolutions that rescinded California's electric vehicle sales mandates and diesel engine rules. Ford CEO Jim Farley praised Trump in a statement ahead of the event for aligning fuel economy standards with market realities. "We can make real progress on carbon emissions and energy efficiency while still giving customers choice and affordability." General Motors CEO Mary Barra noted at an event on December 2nd that before Congress blocked California's zero-emission vehicle rules in June, the auto sector was facing requirements in some states that 35% of new vehicles sold in 2026 must be EVs. "We're going to have to start shutting down plants because we weren't going to be able to build and sell those vehicles," Barra said. 17 animals rescued, 4 cats dead in Canandaigua home, by Madison Scott, Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, USA Today Network. 2 people were arrested after the Ontario County Humane Society rescued 17 animals and found 4 dead cats in their Canandaigua home December 2nd. Sheila LaFleur, 63, and Robin Burr, 61, were arrested and charged with animal cruelty, a misdemeanor, according to the Ontario County Humane Society. The Ontario County Sheriff's Office assisted the Humane Society in executing a search warrant for their home on Overlook Lane in the town of Canandaigua, following an investigation into an animal neglect complaint that was filed on November 29th. The complaint, according to the Humane Society, was filed by an Ohio Animal Rescue, citing concerns about unsanitary conditions and a lack of medical care for animals at the home after the rescue retrieved 2 dogs that were being fostered in the home. During the search warrant, 14 dogs of various mixed breeds and ages were seized from the home, along with 3 cats, the Humane Society stated. 4 dead cats were found in the kitchen freezer. Some dogs were found in metal cages while others were freely roaming the residence, according to the Humane Society. All of the seized animals were taken to the Humane Society shelter for medical evaluations, which found the animals all had fleas, fur loss, dental issues, and ear infections, the press release stated. The 4 dead cats were taken to the Cornell Animal Diagnostic Center for necropsies to determine their cause of death. LaFleur and Burr were released and issued appearance tickets to appear in court at a later date. The Humane Society stated that the town of Canandaigua code enforcement officer deemed the residence uninhabitable due to severe hoarding conditions. RPO hit by cyber attack, says donor data not compromised, by Kayla Kane, Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. The Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra said a cyber attack temporarily cut off access to parts of its IT network in October. Orchestra officials are working with cybersecurity experts to further secure the network. The system that houses our patron and donor transaction data was not impacted by the incident, and our FPO spokesperson said in a statement, "We are working closely with our security team and our employees to determine the extent of which other sensitive data might have been impacted and are exploring all remediation options available." The RPO did not provide any further details about the attack. It said all issues have since been fixed, and security measures in place limited the impact of the incident. Wegmans pulls two nut products over potential salmonella. Marsha Greenwood, Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. Wegmans Food Markets is recalling its deluxe unsalted mixed nuts in two sizes because of potential presence of the bacteria salmonella. The affected products are Wegmans Deluxe Unsalted Mixed Nuts 34-ounce family pack. The UPC is 0-77890-42131-4. The best by date is July 28, 2026, and the lot number is DC58041. Both are listed below the lid on the side of the tub. Wegmans Deluxe Unsalted Mixed Nuts 11.5 ounces. The UPC is 0-77890-42135-2. The best by date is August 10th, 2026, and the lot number is DC58171. Both are listed on the back of the bag at the bottom. The recall was issued December 2nd. The products may be returned to Wegmans service desks for refunds. Wegmans customer service line is 855-934-3663 and is open daily from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. Most people who are infected with salmonella experience diarrhea, fever, and stomach cramps, which typically begin 6 hours to 6 days after swallowing the bacteria. The symptoms usually resolve in 4 to 7 days without treatment. Some people, especially children younger than 5, adults 65 and older, and people with weakened immune systems may experience more severe illnesses that require medical treatment or hospitalization. Woman accused of climbing through window to shoot acquaintance in bed. By Victoria E. Farrell, New York Connect Team. A Rochester woman is accused of shooting an acquaintance who was lying in her own bed in September, according to police. Around 6:15 a.m., September 18, officers were called to a Finch Street residence where they found a woman in her 20s who had been shot multiple times in the upper body. The woman, who was not identified by police, was taken to Strong Memorial Hospital with life-threatening injuries, Bellow said. She is expected to survive, he said. Sornawa Rodriguez, 43, was charged with attempted second-degree murder, first-degree assault, first-degree burglary, and second-degree criminal possession of a weapon, all felonies, in connection with the shooting, Bellow said. Rodriguez is accused of climbing through a window and shooting the woman as the shooting victim was in bed, he said. The two women knew one another via a third-party male, Bellow said. Rodriguez was apprehended December 2nd during a traffic stop in Buffalo and was arraigned in Rochester City Court on December 3rd. She pleaded not guilty and was remanded to the Monroe County Jail in lieu of $200,000 cash bail or $400,000 bond, according to court records. She is due to return to court on December 8th. Finch Street is a residential road that intersects with Lexington and Driving Park Avenues and is within the city Egerton neighborhood. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Assistant principal accused of unwanted contact with students. New York Connect Team, USA Today Network. The City of Geneva Police Department announced the arrest of James Jr. Nunez, 50, of Geneva on December 2nd, following an investigation into an alleged incident at Geneva High School. Nunez, a high school assistant principal in the Geneva City School District, is charged with endangering the welfare of a child, a Class A misdemeanor, and a second-degree harassment, a violation. Police say the charges stem from an alleged incident November 18th in which Nunez is accused of subjecting a student to inappropriate and unwanted physical contact. Authorities said they believe this is an isolated case and that no other students are involved. Nunez was processed at the Geneva Police Department and transported to the Ontario County Jail for arraignment. The investigation remains ongoing, with police working alongside the Ontario County District Attorney's Office and the Geneva Central School District. Anyone with information is urged to contact the Geneva Police Department at 315-828-6771 or Detective Jordan Dobies at 315-828-6780. Tips can remain anonymous. Proposed deal could alter churches' political roles. Texas court considers case on restrictions. Angelie Latham, Nashville, Tennessean, USA Today Network. Arguments were heard on November 25th in a case that could overturn decades of First Amendment precedent that bars churches from endorsing political candidates, potentially reshaping the role of religion in politics. In a Texas courtroom, lawyers for Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, who are seeking to intervene in a case, asked the judge to reject a proposal settlement between the Internal Revenue Service and a group of high-profile religious groups that would effectively gut the Johnson Amendment. The hearing ended with the judge allowing all parties to file short letter briefs by December 5. The Johnson Amendment was introduced by former President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1954 when he was serving as U.S. Senate Majority Leader. It bans all tax-exempt organizations from directly or indirectly participating in politics, specifically from endorsing or opposing candidates. The proposed settlement is the result of a lawsuit that was filed in September 2024 by National Religious Broadcasters, an international association of evangelical conservative communicators, as well as Intercessors for America, a conservative Christian prayer advocacy group, and the two Texas churches. The groups argued that the Johnson Amendment unfairly restricted their First Amendment rights to free speech and free exercise of religion. In a statement issued when the lawsuit was filed, the NRB stated that the groups felt that their speech was being wrongfully silenced. For too long, churches have been instructed to remain silent on pressing matters of conscience and conviction during the election season or risk their 501c3 status, said NRB President and CEO Troy Miller. We believe that all nonprofits should have the constitutional right to freely express their point of view on candidates, elections, and issues on the ballot. Our challenge to the Johnson Amendment is about securing the future of free expression for all Americans, particularly those standing in the pulpit. In July, the IRS said in court filings that churches and other religious 501c3 organizations can endorse political candidates in certain circumstances, a major reversal of norms under the Johnson Amendment. Originally, the federal government defended the Johnson Amendment, but in July 2025, the Trump administration flip-flopped. Rachel Lasser, president and CEO of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, told the Tennessean, and so the government joined with groups bringing the lawsuit and asked the court to approve the settlement. Lasser said her group is now asking the court to intervene because no one is defending the Johnson Amendment. This is a law that we have very strong interest in preserving, she said. A spokesperson for the Broadcasters Association told the Tennessean that Michael Farris, counsel for the plaintiffs, as well as counsel for the IRS, argued that the First Amendment doctrine of church autonomy prevents the IRS from evaluating the legality of a pastor's sermon. In addition, Farris argued that Americans United for the Separation of Church and State as a 501c3 impacted by the Johnson Amendment has never claimed that it wanted to speak about candidates and thus could not claim to have a stake in the argument. The original complaint explicitly says the plaintiffs are not seeking lobbying rights or the right to make political donations, only the right to engage in more political speech. Lasser said his argument is dangerous. The last thing we need is more dark money funding elections and churches, she said. Houses of worship are unaccountable when it comes to reporting their money. People who care deeply about the integrity of elections should care deeply about the Johnson Amendment. In the IRS July filing, the agency stated that political endorsements made by a church would not be seen as participating or intervening in political campaigns, but instead as a family discussion concerning politics. Lasser pushed back on this argument as well. This is part of a broader campaign to misuse religion and our country's sacred concept of religious freedom to advance political goals in a way that corrupts religion and religious freedom, and that's a sad day, she said. Americans United for the Separation of Church and State isn't alone in its stance. In response to the IRS July reversal, a large group of nonprofits, including a number of major religious organizations, signed on to a letter urging President Donald Trump to object to the changes. The undersigned organizations right to object to efforts by your administration to ignore long-standing federal law by attempting to exempt houses of worship and religious organizations from the Johnson Amendment, which clearly prohibits 501c3 nonprofit organizations from endorsing or opposing partisan political candidates, the letter reads. These efforts undermine one of the most trusted sections of civil society, nonpartisan houses of worship and charitable nonprofits. The group also stated their opposition to the IRS equation of political talk at the pulpit with family discussions. Moreover, if the court approves this settlement, houses of worship would be subject to intense political pressure to engage in electoral politics from down ballot races and primaries to the presidency, distracting them from their missions, the letter stated. It would also create a loophole for political donors to enjoy tax-deductible donations for their political campaign contributions, exploiting houses of worship for political gains. Diane Yentl, president and CEO of the National Council of Nonprofits, said in the days leading up to the November 25 hearing that the proposed changes to the amendment threaten to destroy precedent that protects nonprofits. Removing these protections could severely damage the integrity and effectiveness of the entire sector, she said. San Francisco's beloved albino alligator dies, by Phi Nijin, USA Today. Claude, a rare albino alligator and the unofficial mascot of the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, has died at the age 30, the museum announced December 2nd. The alligator, whose unique appearance and calm personality dazzled millions of visitors for nearly 20 years, had been under the care of a team in recent weeks due to waning appetite, according to the museum. He was recently moved from his swampy enclosure for treatment for a suspected infection. Though Claude received intensive care from veterinarians and animal care teams, the museum said the heartbreaking outcome is not what we hoped for. The University of California Davis School of Veterinary Medicine will conduct a full exam and necropsy to determine the official cause of death. He brought joy to millions of people at the museum and across the world. His quiet charisma captivating the hearts of fans of all ages, the museum said in a statement. We know that the magnitude of this loss will be felt in proportion to how beloved Claude was by so many across the Bay Area and beyond. After moving to San Francisco in 2008, Claude became a local icon and was celebrated by fans worldwide. The museum said he regularly received fan mail, gifts, and artwork. Claude, who was believed to be one of the oldest albino alligators in human care, celebrated his 30th birthday in September with month-long festivities held at the museum across San Francisco and on social media, according to the museum. The museum noted that it plans to hold a public memorial. In the meantime, the museum encouraged people to share memories of Claude and send messages to his caretakers by emailing Claude at calacademy.org or writing to the California Academy of Sciences. Claude, an American alligator, hatched on September 15, 1995, an alligator farm in Louisiana, according to the California Academy of Sciences. He was transferred to a zoo in Florida as a banana-sized baby and received care there for 13 years, the museum said. Claude had bright white scales and was nearly blind to his albinism, a genetic condition that reduces the amount of melanin in the body. at the museum as the museum prepared to open in August 2008, it said Claude traveled for 4 days from Florida to move into a brand new swamp exhibit. He officially made his debut at the museum September 27, 2008. Claude initially was paired with Bonnie, a non-albino female alligator, according to the museum. Bonnie and Claude weren't great partners in crime, so Bonnie was returned to Florida, the museum said. SFGATE and the San Francisco Chronicle reported in 2009 that Claude's poor eyesight caused him to bump into Bonnie, and she bit off his toe. After Bonnie moved back to Florida, Claude resided and peacefully coexisted with three alligator snapping turtles named Morla, Donatella, and Raphael, according to the museum. During his 17 years at the California Academy of Sciences, Claude was an educational animal ambassador and helped educate the public about his species and albinism, according to the museum. Claude also inspired children's books, and in April of this year, the museum launched a live webcam feed of Claude. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Filing shows IRS interest in Flint Settlement Fund. Paul Egan, Detroit Free Press, USA Today Network. Lansing, Michigan. Uncle Sam has yet to acknowledge any federal liability in the 2014 lead poisoning of residents in Flint, Michigan, but he's on a line for a cut from the civil settlement fund, according to a recent court filing. Deborah Greenspan, the special master assisting U.S. District Judge Judith Levy with managing a $626.25 million civil settlement and related litigation for Flint residents, said in two November 21st court filings that she and other officials are close to resolving of the nearly 26,000 claims seeking a share of the money, though she still gave no dates for when payments would be issued. Greenspan sought to modify expectations for residents who awaited more than a decade to be compensated for the poisoning of their drinking water supply. Through a series of errors made by state and city officials, as well as others, the highest possible awards, other than those for deaths due to a Legionnaires' disease outbreak linked to the water contamination, will be about $100,000, Greenspan said in the court filing. All other awards for young children without such high lead levels, or for other children and adults will be considerably lower, Greenspan wrote. Officials said that the settlement fund has earned tens of millions of dollars in interest since it was created in November 2021. The exact amount of interest earnings to date have not been disclosed. Greenspan said in a second court filing that because of its classified as a trust, settlement fund earnings such as interest and are taxable by the Internal Revenue Service at a maximum rate of 37%, though administrative costs could be used to reduce the amount of tax owed. Though it is in line for a share of the settlement fund, the federal government, through the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, continues to fight Flint lawsuits and deny partial responsibility for the Flint water crisis. The two other levels of government, the state of Michigan and the city of Flint, contributed $600 million and $20 million respectively to the settlement fund. Greenspan recommended that attorneys in the case also get a share of the earned interest, as they have requested over the opposition of Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel's office. Greenspan said that both precedents from other class action or mass tort lawsuits and the wording of the settlement agreement itself support the attorney's position, not the AG's. While the state's position is very sympathetic and it is intended to preserve more funds for the claimants, the case law and contract construction principles support the opposite conclusion, Greenspan wrote. Her recommendation on interest earnings are subject to approval by Levy, who has yet to rule as December 1st. So far, the only payments made to Flint claimants are $4.6 million Levy has authorized in five wrongful death claims related to Legionnaires' disease based on court records. More than $7 million has also been paid from the settlement fund to support Flint school programming. Sudan force holding siege survivors. RSF demanding large ransoms from relatives, by Nasina Elhar and Reed Levinson, Reuters, Cairo. The Sudanese paramilitary force that besieged the overrun city in Dufar in late October is systematically holding trapped residents for ransom, killing or beating those families cannot pay, witnesses, aid workers, and researchers say. Reuters could not determine exactly how many people the paramilitary rapid support forces and allied militants have detained in or around Al-Fashar, capital of North Darfur, but the accounts suggest that large groups are being held in a cluster of villages within 50 miles of Al-Fashar, while others have been brought back to the city as the RSF demands payments worth thousands of dollars from the relatives. Their detention shows the risk faced by those who were unable to reach safety from Al-Fashar, which had been a final significant holdout against the RSF in the western Darfur region before its fall. Witnesses have described mass reprisals, including summary executions and sexual violence since the RSF takeover. It also sheds light on the plight of some of the tens of thousands of people who are unaccounted for as aid agencies push to gain access to famine-stricken Al-Fashar and its environs, which became a focal point in the 12 two-year-old war between RSF and Sudan's army. 21 two-year. Reuters interviewed 33 former captives as well as 10 aid workers and researchers who provided previously unreported details about the violence captives face, the locations where they were held, and a scale of the detentions. Survivors describe paying ransoms of between $1,400 and $17,000, vast sums in an impoverished region. Many of those who could not pay were shot at close range or mowed down in groups, 11 survivors said, while other captives were badly beaten. A Reuters reporter said survivors who had fled over the border to Chad bearing injuries that appeared to be from beatings and gunshots, Reuters could not verify their accounts in full. They gave you 3 or 4 days, and if you don't transfer the money, they kill you, said Mohammed Ismail, who spoke with Reuters by phone from Twala, a town near Al-Fashar under the control of neutral forces. Ismail said he left Al-Fashar at the RS as the RSF took over the city on October 26, but was captured by the RSF in a village called Jabah among a group of 24 men. He and his nephew Reach made to gather $2,800 from family before being set free. Nine other men were killed in front of them, he said. Ethnically charged violence. As for a comment, RSF legal advisor Mohammed Mutatar said that most cases of detention and extortion of people from the Al-Fashar had been carried out by a rival group whose members disguised themselves in RSF uniforms. As RSF committee is investigating more than 100 cases of alleged abuse in Al-Fashar daily, with a large number of suspects arrested and 9 convicted, the committee's head, Al-Mahari, told Reuters. The capture of Al-Fashar after a 18-month siege was a turning point in the war that erupted from a power struggle between the army and the RSF has been caused what the United Nations had described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Both sides have been accused of war crimes. Up to 250,000 people were estimated to be living in Al-Fashar when the RSF seized the city, tightening its grip on a region where the Arab-dominated force and its allies were blamed for mass killings against ethnic non-Arabs earlier this year, an echo of the genocide in Darfur 20 years before. Survivors of RSF detention in and around Al-Fashar told Reuters they were frequently asked what tribe they belonged to and attacked with racial epithets. The International Organization for Migration estimates that more than 100,000 people have fled Al-Fashar since RSF takeover. 8 agencies say more than 15,000 of those have arrived in Twala, and about 9,500 crossed into Chad, but most remain in RSF-controlled villages around Al-Fashar, including Garni, Korma, Ungaga, Saga, Hayat Aki, Kabalwana, and Tora. Researchers are unclear how many remain within Al-Fashar itself. Aid groups said some residents were unable to flee because they could not pay for transport out of the city or were too sick or injured to travel. One former captive who made it to Chad, Yasser Hamad Ali, 36, said he was captured by RSF fighters on October 29th, along with 16 other men after fleeing Al-Fashar. He said the RSF beat him severely and demanded $42,000 for his release. 8 former captives described being brought back to Al-Fashar, where they were said they were held for ransom in buildings including military facilities and university dormitories. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 5th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle. Your reader has been Donald. Thank you for listening.